Stardate 95678.94. My name's Mike Moody. You are listening to Star Trek Discovery Pod. With me is
Grant Davis.
Grant, we're going to talk about, is this like the best episode of Star Trek Discovery we've seen?
Holy shit, this is one of the best episodes of TV I've seen in a while.
Okay, I wouldn't go that far, dude.
In a while.
I'm watching The Good Place. That's good stuff.
Oh, well. Okay, The Good Place is phenomenal.
Yeah, but dramas, I guess sci-fi. Okay, sci-fi opera, and we're talking sci-fi operas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was extremely riveting. And of course, we're talking about season 2, episode 13 of Star Trek Discovery. What's Past is Prologue.
And what a perfect title that is.
You looked up the title, right?
So this is a reference to a Shakespeare quote from The Tempest. And the quote is, what's past is prologue instead of the past is prologue. But that was just in reference to one of the characters, his motivations, that everything in the past unrelated to them was still in a way a culmination of occurrences that led up to his decision to murder another character. And here it's everything that happened in the past, you know, still has weight and still has meaning. In a way, it kind of reminds me of Lost. And this is probably not the last time I'm going to refer to Lost with this particular episode.
Or the first time. Well, not with this episode, but we know you're a Lost fan.
Yeah. But what happened is a very important theme. And I think when we go into time travel, people get a little bit, you know, upset about the idea of like, oh, well, you can just always go back in time and like erase what happened. But I like that the title is saying like the past is still relevant. It still has ramifications that ripple through time.
Yeah. You know, I didn't think of it that way. That's very true. Before we dive too deep into it, this was directed by Olatunde Osusanmi. And forgive me if I pronounce it incorrectly. And it was written by Ted Sullivan. So
you nailed that one.
That was easy. That was an easy one. So just before we go on, Grant, you're here with me, but Ashley and Clyde are not here with us tonight. I guess they're on an away mission.
You are finally back, though. You've been out for 2 weeks.
That's right.
Gotta admit, I missed you.
Oh, did you miss me?
Yeah, I didn't want to have to be acting Captain Saru. It was too long on this little podcast ship.
So I'm Lorca, then?
You...
You're taking over for me. So am I going to die tonight? Is
that
what's happening?
Bad news, buddy. I believe in our photo, it's me on the end of the sword.
That's true, yeah. Well, I really appreciate you flying the ship while I had to be out on my away mission.
Oh, our metaphors are so good. We just lost all our listeners.
No, we lose our listeners when we talk shit about Star Trek Enterprise.
Oh, that's true.
Which is garbage.
It's one of the best treks, guys.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, I don't hate it, but I have problems with it. Okay, we're not talking about that show. We're talking about Discovery. But before we dive into it, guys, we want to remind you to visit us at StarTrekPod.com. You can find our Facebook page there, find our Twitter page, and, you know, tweet at us and retweet the episode. It really helps us out a lot. You can also find us at Patreon.com/StarTrekPod. You know, throw a few bucks at us, a buck or two. We have a good number of $2 an episode donors who are actually part of our private Slack channel. So if you donate $2 an episode, you'll get an invite to a private Slack channel with us where we can talk all things Star Trek and really just Star Trek Discovery. And I want to give a shout out to some of the people who've done that, but we'll get to that towards the end of the show because I'm really loving hanging out in that Slack channel right now.
Yeah, it's really fun, and I think it's well worth your investment, guys. I think it's a fun community if you love Star Trek and you want to mix theories and discussions with a bunch of other good, lovable fans. Come join us.
Yeah, it's a good time. I also want to mention we're part of the Permanent Record Podcast Network, permanentrcrd.com. Find us there. Find Grant's other show, The TV Dudes, which is going strong. It's like your sixth year already.
Oh, geez. I mean, I've been doing that one for 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we started around 2010, maybe 2011.
Well, every week, every Friday, right? TV Dudes.
Every Friday, yeah. You can hear me talk about all sorts of TV, not just Star Trek. We cover a wide array of shows, both like streaming and not so much on network, but generally the cable fare.
Okay, so let's dive into this episode.
Is it time?
It's time.
Hot takes!
Hot takes. Okay. I think we kind of already showed our hand on the hot takes.
We probably did, but I wanted to hear your full assessment of the episode.
Yeah, okay. I did think this was probably the most riveting episode of the season so far. And it felt like a season finale, didn't
it? Right?
Yeah, it felt like there's so much happening. You know, we got the reveal last week that Lorca is indeed Mirror Lorca. We got the heartbreaking reveal. At least I did. I was still holding out hope for Lorca that, okay, he's rebelling against Mirror Giorgio, who is a fascist, racist dictator.
He could be one of the good humans trying to bring goodness to the Mirrorverse.
Yes, but no. That was so disappointing. However, once I got over my initial disappointment that, yes, Lorca actually is a villain in this show, you know, because I like the... you know, I like the anti-hero aspect of Lorca. I was rooting for him to be an anti-hero.
I mean, nowadays in TV, we're so conditioned to root for the anti-hero.
Right. And that's where I was going. And Jason Isaacs was really playing him that way, building up Michael Burnham throughout the entire season, you know, when everyone else was putting her in a corner. And, of course, she's our hero, so we want to see that relationship. But he's also doing some dark, mysterious things. And yeah, we called it that he was from the Mirror U, but I didn't see that he was really the Trump.
Yes.
If you ask Jason Isaacs, he would say, yes, I was inspired by Trump.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see what a sort of 180 that character does. And I don't know, part of it rubs me a little bit the wrong way because... I feel fair reason to look at his positive aspects in the chapter one portion of this show, where he was making some occasionally dubious calls, but you could see from his perspective that it was for the good of his crew and overall the good of the Federation that he was making certain calls. And it's like, yeah, maybe you need to have not just the shield, but sometimes you need the sword, and he can be a little bit more ruthless, but this is a time of war. You need a war captain. And I can understand the perspective that he's giving to the Federation. They can't all just be these pure ideologues. But that all really disappears with his first speech, I think, that he gives. And it's like basically this really xenophobic speech about like even Giorgio's like giving a pass to these aliens and letting them invade our borders. And I'm like, okay, this is very Trumpian.
Giorgio, you're not racist enough. Damn it. You're not nationalistic enough. I'm here to make everything white.
Yeah, it just like my eyebrows went way up, and I was like,
yeah.
He even says, make the empire, what was it?
Did he say make the empire great again?
No, he didn't say great. Make the empire glorious again.
Oh,
he
okay.
He actually uses that, wow. Which, I mean, it goes to show you that they're really trying to point out that the perspective of the Mirror Universe is so antithetical to what the Federation represents, as well as our current political climate, and the Donald Trump and the GOP that are in charge are antithetical to these ideals. And sorry if we rub some people the wrong way there, but not too much, because I think it needs to be pointed out.
I think it definitely needs to be pointed out. I think the show is unapologetic in telling this story as a metaphor for what's going on in our current political climate, in our current social climate. It's right there on the screen. And what was great about this episode was that metaphor was front and center. And especially with, you know, Lorca versus Michael Burnham versus Saru, because you have the great idealism of Star Trek, of the Federation running. There's a thread of that running throughout the entire series. But it really came to a forefront here when our heroes on the Discovery and Michael Burnham on the, what was Giorgio's ship called?
The Charon,
yeah.
Chiron?
Something like that. Yeah, Chiron. They're both... Drink your beer, Grant. They're both drawing inspiration from this idealism, from their world where they came from, when somebody like Lorca is against that and trying to crush it. And ultimately, he does lose. But, you know, there have been a lot of arguments that the show is, and we've talked about this a lot, it's darker, it is very dystopian, especially when we're hanging out in the mirror you. But there's a reason for that in my perspective. I think the show is doing something really smart by telling a story that is going into the mirror universe. And like you said, showing us the exact opposite ideals of the Federation, which underscores just how important and aspirational those ideals are. And I think that this episode did that really well.
I completely agree. In fact, Ashley was talking last week about that very idea that she was a little bit disappointed, maybe not disappointed, but kind of losing her sense of how this fits into what she had envisioned for the Star Trek universe and their quest for idealism and righteousness, I guess. And I feel like this episode finally brought everything to a culmination point that allowed them to draw that sharp contrast and finally express those ideals in such a pure and distilled way. Saru's speech was beautiful.
It really was. I started getting really emotional during that speech because not only was it a beautifully written speech, mm-hmm. a beautifully acted speech, and a few days ago I just saw The Shape of Water, so I'm on this Doug Jones kick where yeah. I just think he's better and better in everything I see him in. But as a Star Trek fan, that moment was very Picard.
Right?
Inspiring the crew, and he cuts that slender figure like Picard as well. But he also worked in a few Kirk-esque lines in there as well. So it was really, it felt like the writers and the show was embracing the Star Trek of the past and reminding us, hey, we're still part of that lineage, even though we're doing something new, which I loved.
And it wasn't just Saru and his speech, because then you see from that point, it trickles to everyone from the Prime Universe, like all taking up that mantle and saying, this is what we truly stand for. You see Burnham makes a move, and we can kind of tell he's a bit of a gambit, but it seems like she's also doing the self-sacrificial, I will stay here and be, in a way, Lorca's...
not girlfriend?
his mind boo or whatever. I don't know what was going on. But
like a right-hand man, yeah.
Yeah, but she will sacrifice herself for the good of not only her crew, but the salvation of the entire multiverse. But like not just her, and then we also see that Tilly and Stamets also go ahead and like reinforce that same ideal with like, hey, you know what? There's no problem too big that we can't figure out some way to solve this. And even if it results in something that might happen to Stamets, you know, him going back into the mycelium network, that could be dangerous, but they are risking all because A, they know they could die, but B, the stakes are too high for them to allow what the mirror universe stands for to continue.
You know, I was really happy that the show decided to amp up the stakes more than they've ever been amped up before in this series, because more than once, characters were saying the fate of the universe is on the line here.
Yeah.
Right? More than once. And I don't think we've gotten that before. We've gotten our territory, the Federation, this planet, but the entire universe is on the line. And even though you know this is a prequel, they're going to make it out okay, I felt the show needed to do that because the other stakes that were going on over on the Chiron, it was mainly about the battle between Lorca and Georgiou. And of course, Michael Burnham is there.
Yeah.
And you want her to get out, and you want to see her die hard her way through the situation, which was kind of fun. But between, like, I wasn't really invested in that battle between Georgiou and Lorca.
Because, I wrote this exact same note. I'm like, okay. Who am I rooting for here?
Who was I rooting for? Because
I want them both to just destroy, mutual destruction.
Exactly. Like, no one here has been redeemed, you know? Sure, Georgiou and Michael are having some nice talks, and it's great to see those actors back together again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the best scenes, not my favorite scenes or exchanges in this episode, was Georgiou and Burnham. I just really like that relationship, even though we're looking at a mirror Georgiou. I think they play off each other really well. They have that mother-daughter dynamic, which is nice. And that was translated here, even though it was still mirror Georgiou. So I'm emotionally feeling for this version of Giorgio, but my brain is like, but she's also a nationalistic racist emperor who's going to kill everybody who is not human.
It's Palpatine versus not even cool Darth Vader. It's like Anakin from the prequels. And you're like, who am I rooting for here? You both are just kind of scummy.
Yeah, it's like Palpatine versus Dooku. No, that's way shittier. I'm sorry. But yeah, you felt the same way, huh? It was hard. I thought they were going to redeem Giorgio at the end a little more. They started to do it, but it feels like they're really, you know, we're probably going to get that story of her redemption down the line because now she's stuck with our heroes in the Prime universe.
Yeah, they keep taking on these misfits and these what you would might think are irredeemable characters, starting with Burnham, and Burnham has earned her redemption. And then we thought, Lorca, if Lorca goes bad, could he earn? Nope, never mind, Lorca's gone.
No.
But then we have Ash Tyler slash Vok, whatever it is.
And I remain Vok.
But he seems to be just Ash Tyler now with this kind of remains to be seen, and I wouldn't be surprised if Vok is still lurking beneath the surface to some degree and will kind of plague that character. He'll still kind of struggle with this sort of duality. But now we have an evil emperor of the mirror universe who has lost her empire and now is sort of at the mercy of a completely different, like philosophically opposed universe.
Right.
And where does she stand within that?
You know, story-wise, it's a pretty great decision because now
it's very Lost, man. It's not pretty only Lost. Did this feel like a Lost season finale with just how epic in scope everything was,
sure,
but this idea of bringing on these people that you think are irredeemable, and then either you get a flashback episode or you have just a couple scenes where all of a sudden they do something that you're like, whoa, that was pretty pretty big of you.
Yeah. Right. It's great from a storytelling standpoint because not only can you get a really great character-centric episode or story with Giorgio being redeemed, but it allows a character like Michael or the other characters on the ship to have scenes where they teach her about the importance and the greatness of the ideals of the Federation and why they choose that and why they live that and why they fight for it. And in a way, reminding us, the viewer, of why that's important, which is what a lot of us want from a Star Trek series. We want to see the compass pointing towards that idealistic, aspirational future. And we want to hear about how we get there and why it's important. And it feels like, you know, they can do that with the Giorgio character, not only push her there, but kind of teach her, like, this is why it's important.
But you certainly don't think that now that we see them back in this universe that we're going to get this more positive and uplifting Star Trek. It's still going to be them struggling like week to week and shit going sideways.
I hear what you're saying, but this show's doing such a great thing. It's almost Trojan horsing its idealism into this post-apocalyptic, dystopian, dark sci-fi show. Do you feel that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's doing that. And I think it's going to continue doing that. I think they kind of showed their hand here. But then at the end of the episode, even though good prevailed, even though we had this whole metaphor about the mycelium network being corrupted really by the spirit of this evil empire, because all they want to do is pervert and drain this natural resource that is eventually going to kill everyone because of how they're strangling it, right? Mm-hmm. So we get our heroes with the idealism who save it. So our heroes with their idealism, they win the day and they save the mycelium network and they're able to go back home. Star Trek idealism wins the day. But then what happens? We're 9 months in the future. The Klingons have won the war and we're getting a war story all over again. So we have that balance of idealism with the dystopian, you know, the dystopian story of the Klingons fucking shit up.
It's funny because it's like you think, oh, okay, that idealism wins out. And I know we keep using the word idealism, but, you know, whatever. The Federation mission statement. And then you go, oh, but hold up, there's a catch.
Yeah.
No, it isn't, because they're pretty much losing the war, and now they can't even get the Federation on comm to talk to them, because 9 months later, like, most of their troops are decimated.
So what do you think? You think they're going to tap Emperor Giorgio's, you know, wartime
prowess
and experience to get this territory back from the Klingons? Do you think that's where we're going?
It seems like, if you saw the preview for the next episode, they are going to do that a bit. But I feel like with time travel being introduced, they always have that sort of escape hatch to go and try and change things again, go back into the past. But if they do that, maybe that would be a way to kind of bring back some characters that have left the show. Maybe that would be a way back for Jason Isaacs' character, or for Dr. Culber, perhaps.
I would love to see both of them back on the show. We don't know if Isaacs is coming back. Right after the episode, there was an interview with him that popped up on The Hollywood Reporter, and he did not confirm whether or not he's coming back. The only thing he did confirm was that he does not yet have a contract for season two.
Oh, okay.
And we don't know if he's going to show up again in season one or season two. So we're not sure.
I'm so mixed on it, because as a fan of these characters, of course I want them being brought back, and the mechanic of having time travel exist means, like, oh, you can just write it in and just drop those characters kind of back in, and it's science fiction, have them regenerate or something. I don't think they generally do that in Star Trek. Mm-mm. But, you know, as a fan of storytelling, I do like the idea of there being an actual stakes to someone's death. I want death to have a greater meaning than just being out for a few episodes. It's not a comic book.
Yeah, I don't think these writers are going to do that. I don't think they're going to cheat with time travel that way, because we have seen characters come back. We saw Culber come back in a way, but it wasn't, you know, they didn't go back and save him. They didn't jump into DeLorean, gun it to 88 and go back and save him, right? He was more, his consciousness and existence was alive in the mycelial network to guide Stamets, which actually worked in a really beautiful, dramatic moment in this episode. And
in last, I feel like it was actually just sort of a replay of last episode, right? It was just little clips of him saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, they did. I think they did add a few more lines here.
Okay.
Yeah, because I like last week's, but this week's, it got me pretty emotional. And with Giorgio, they brought Giorgio back, but they didn't do it in this ham-fisted, oh, we know the fans like Giorgio, so we're going to bring her back. They did it in a really great way that really twists and turns Michael Burnham emotionally. They kind of earned that character coming back.
Well, now that we're jumping to the point in the show where they've obviously come back into a timeline where the war is being lost, I want to ask you if you think this is a potential third timeline, or is this still the true timeline, and this is just the way the war went, that they started losing until they deployed some dastardly Emperor Giorgio tactics to kind of turn things around?
No, this is it. This is a prime timeline. I mean, I don't want it to be some alternate timeline or whatever. Like when they realized they had jumped into the future, and right before they revealed it was only 9 months, which of course it means a lot in wartime, but in Star Trek that's like whatever, that's a sneeze, you know. Yeah. Right before they revealed the 9 months, I thought, okay, did we jump to the future of the next gen?
That's what we like. So many people have been theorizing.
I know, like, are we going to be beyond Deep Space Nine, beyond Voyager? That would be cool. And that would make sense because, you know, the Spore Drive is not alive in Star Trek in the past and all that stuff. But no, they didn't do that. They didn't want to go that crazy. It was only 9 months. So that's kind of a signal to me that we are back in the Prime universe. We're only 9 months. The reason the writers threw time travel in there was because they wanted to tell this story of the underdog, that we're now the underdog in the Klingon War. Mm. Because when we left the Prime Universe, we were winning the war. We were kicking ass.
Yeah.
We as in the Federation. Now we're back and we're the underdogs again. We have three more episodes to go. maybe this Klingon War arc is going to go into season two. So yeah, I don't think we're gonna keep jumping back and forth throughout time to fix things.
Well, speaking of jumping back and forth in time, I want to jump back to talk about the Spore Drive. And I also want to note that sweet segue I just did right there. But talking about the Spore Drive and how in the Mirror Universe, they're actually using it as this the Spore Network to become some sort of... looks like
a weapon?
Like a micro star energy
right.
Center that's powering the ship and powering weapons that they use in order to destroy planets, kind of like a Death Star or something.
Yeah, pretty much.
So they the Stamets of the Mirror Universe had figured out the mycelium network as well, but he had exploited it in a different way to be an energy source rather than a travel nexus.
Right. He was pulling from it and manipulating it instead of diving into it and using it the way it was supposed to be used, like our Stamets was.
But somehow, in still trying to investigate, I guess, how it was working and how he could still keep pulling resources from it when it seemed to be a dwindling resource, he got locked and trapped inside of the network, like mentally. And I guess my question is...
That makes sense, Grant.
Well, they talk about how this is eventually going to destroy the rest of not just this galaxy or this universe, but also the Prime Universe, because they obviously share a link. Mm-hmm. And they show this visually within the mindscape that both Stamets were sharing as this sort of skin rash, this disease that's spreading. But it was not really clear how that mental manifestation translates in the physical world, I guess. Like, how is the mycelium network being destroyed there actually destructive to the bonds of space and time itself?
You're right. I really appreciated that they amped up that threat. Like I said, there's a threat to the entire universe now. I like that. However, as the episode went on and they didn't do that, they didn't make that threat, you know, clear as how it would.
It was just Sam and sort of saying that, and everyone's yeah. like, no evidence needed, bro. We're with you.
Exactly. Yeah. It did feel empty and kind of hollow and not real and just kind of like a plot device.
Yeah.
Totally. It was pretty empty. That's probably my biggest criticism here. That the biggest threat that we were told about in this episode, we didn't really feel. But the good thing about the threat was that it really energized our discovery crew and brought them together.
Energized.
Yeah.
That's a good word for it, too.
And we saw people on the crew who we don't often hear get lines talking, like Robot Girl.
Yeah. Wait. I wrote down her name here.
Yeah, I did, too.
Arium.
Okay. I think they need to work on her voice modulator because she's not very intelligible.
It sounds wonky. Yeah. I'm like, don't speak.
Like, just look cool, man. don't talk.
If you're a robot, can't they just give you a nicer voice like Siri or something?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Come on.
But isn't she second in line then after Saru? Wouldn't she become, if he's presumably captain?
Oh,
I'm not sure
that.
About the whole chain of command, but it seems like she's the one he puts in charge.
Yeah, I guess so.
And so she would actually be first officer now.
Maybe
we'll see more of Arium.
You know, I really like that we now have an alien who is the captain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. That's not usually the case. We always have a male captain. I mean, there are aliens in the Federation who are captains.
But a male human captain, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we have, you know, an alien who is the captain of the starship of a Star Trek show. That just doesn't happen. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, you know, people were also rooting for Burnham. And I think it's a possibility that eventually she might also move into that role. But Burnham still has that mark on her record that might make her somewhat ineligible. And she still is this amazing jack of all trades. And props to her in this episode. The actress, Sinequa Martin-Green, is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah.
She was fantastic.
I think so, too. She gets better and better.
I was just so impressed with the scenes where she's talking both to Georgia to kind of hype her up and like get her to go along with the situation, and then her confrontation with Lorca. And I was just like fully invested, not in like the actress and her performance, but in the character. I was just like fully like enwrapped in it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's credit to her. I thought it was such a good job there.
Yeah, she did a great job embodying everything that she had to do in this episode. You know, so did Jason Isaacs, man. You know, from one perspective, you could see like, okay, this is a completely different character, the way it's written, you know? So many things he's done in the past don't line up with what's happening in this episode, but he really sells it. And I bought the idea that he is just this master manipulator with his grand plan. And I liked the scene where he is awakening his evil crew from the what do they call it? The death telephone booths or whatever they are.
Oh, yeah. What were those?
The things? Agonizers.
The Agonizers.
Yeah.
But it totally looked like Bill and Ted sort of thing. Like they're all like zapping into there.
Right.
I was like, what?
Yeah. It's the Circuits of Time, dude.
And there are so many of them. So many Agonizers there.
Yeah. It's the Hall of Agonizers. But I like seeing him wake up his crew, because at that point I was thinking he's still a good guy. Mm. And then they twist the knife. No, he's really a bad guy. Did you think he was really going to be this bad?
No.
Yeah.
I was totally on the opposite end, like sort of rooting for him to take down Georgia. But nope, it turns out maybe I was rooting for Georgia only slightly, because I felt a little bit extra betrayed by me, the viewer's investment in this character.
Yeah. So if Jason Isaacs does come back as Lorca, what do you want to see? What will we see?
Okay. So that's a fun question, because my one theory had been this idea that we would find that the original Prime Lorca is imprisoned in the menagerie in some sort of like hidden compartment.
Ooh, I like that.
Like, what if he came in, he was able to subdue the other Lorca, and he didn't actually kill him. Instead, he thought, you know, I'm going to keep you as a puppet. I'm going to take information from you. I'm going to keep you alive in here. But he just has him imprisoned in his little private quarters. That's one way to have the other Lorca return to the scene. But would that Lorca be able to resume being a captain? I don't know. Mm. Like, maybe that's a little bit too messy. Here's another one that I didn't come up with, but I read a quick theory before I came over here to record.
You want to edit that out?
No.
Do you want to take credit for it?
No, I won't take credit.
I can
for
do
it.
That.
You know, I don't mind.
It's magic.
But we see this scene where he falls into the mycelium star thingy, and it vaporizes him, and he becomes part of the spores. And then we see, after our crew, the Discovery crew, travels back to the Prime Universe, all the spores floating around, all these blue spores, but we see one curiously green spore float down and fall on Tilly's shoulder. Was this part of him? Is he now a part of the mycelium network? And will that allow him to in some way infect and spread and take over other people?
You didn't think that was just an artistic grace note?
It seemed peculiar. Like, it could have been one of the blue spores falls and drops, but they made it specifically green. They don't have her noticing it, like, oh, look at this beautiful thing. So it seemed a little bit more sinister, I guess, that one particular, it was like radioactive almost, and it falls on her.
I was confused by why it was green, and part of me thought it was a callback to one of the earlier episodes in which Stamets, I think he dusts off his shoulder, but he's dusting off some of those spores that are in the air, and they look really beautiful when he does that. It's like, oh, here's another one of those landing on Tilly. It's a beautiful bookend, visual bookend we're seeing to the craziness of this spore drive story. But I was confused why it was green.
See, my personal theory, not the one that I read online, was that is not just your run-of-the-mill generic spore. That's this super hyper-intelligent magic spore called a midichlorian.
No.
And it landed on Tilly, and he's going to make a make her pregnant with a baby who's going to grow up to hate sand.
Grant, we're in the wrong franchise, man. Wrong franchise. Come back to Star Trek. I know you're new to Star Trek.
Okay, okay.
But it's different.
I'm back.
It's different.
Back to Klingons and Vulcans and whichever's which.
Speaking of Klingons, are you excited that we're back in the Klingon War? Do you want to see more Klingons? Do you want to see more fighting with them?
I don't think that the Klingon War was particularly that interesting to me.
Even, they didn't do much with it.
Yeah, even in the beginning is like what we would see is them like jump in and out of battles, but it was more about the relationships between everyone on board and seeing that kind of develop. That was what was interesting, and I think that will remain what's most interesting to me going forward. I like the character drama aspect, but that said, the fact that time travel has now played a role in this and that the spore drive is, I think, still relevant. I think that those spores were still in the air and that Stamets makes a line about like it's regenerating, like all the networks regenerating. That is still this, what do you call it, Chekhov's gun, right, that you're just waiting to be used and again in the future.
Chekhov's mushroom.
Chekhov's mushroom.
Yeah, I'm actually excited that we're back in the Klingon War because I don't think the show did a lot with it in the first half of the season. Mm-hmm. And I know we only have 3 episodes left. Maybe the war will drag on till season 2. But I would really like to see more, not just battles, but we were told if you're a Star Trek fan, you know that the Klingon War was mostly a Cold War. There were battles, but there was a lot of spy shit happening. And I would love to see a story like that. We kind of get that with Valk and Ash, but I would like to see more Klingon subterfuge and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know what exactly they might have envisioned for this or how long they want to prolong the Klingon War. I would sort of anticipate that we're not going to linger too long on it. Maybe it will just be 3 episodes, but maybe it will be another whole season where they are integral to kind of bringing this to a close.
So we have 3 episodes left.
Yeah.
And we did not see Ash Tyler / Valk in this episode. He is off in sick bay with a force field around him in agonizing pain, we're guessing.
Just recovering from some light brain surgery to move in an entire other person from him.
Yes. So I have a feeling that he's going to be a big part of the last few episodes of this season. You might have talked about this last week when I wasn't here, but do you have any theories about where we're going with him in that story?
I mean, before the idea was that because he is a person who is now a Klingon living in a human body and has the consciousness of a human also living inside of him, that he's going to start understanding the differences and starting to relate and empathize with both the human experience and the Klingon experience. And the two competing sides of him would come together to be able to be that person who could finally bridge the gap between cultures and be the mediator that is able to end the war.
Yeah.
But now I don't know because they presumably had Laurel just remove Valk from the equation.
Right.
And she grieves. She screams out in agony because Valk no longer exists within that body.
Well, because she fucked him up, bro. It was her plan. She screwed everything up for him. I think Ash Tyler somehow, and maybe Laurel, are going to be key in ending this Klingon War and creating what we fans know as the truce between the Klingons and the Federation going forward. I'm looking forward to that. I don't know how Georgiou's warmongering and her ideas to probably blow up the Klingons is going to work out with that, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if it's going to be like, hey, we're going to bring you in. You got some new ideas spitballing from the Mirror Universe. What do you got? And she's like, let's murder everyone. Just go on mass genocide. And they're like, never mind. That's not what we stand for. And even if we did win, we don't want to win that way. Sorry, back to the brig with you.
Yeah, here, read these philosophy books.
You're kind of a bad person. Yes. Have you ever thought about that? You're just not good.
You're not going to the good place.
Speaking of bad person, there were some badass fight scenes in this episode too.
Dude, the choreography, the fight choreography in here was badass. The gunfights were badass.
That hallway scene where like she's standing there with a force field and she's got the turrets ready to like.
Come
like,
on. Yeah.
Like, and they were shooting to vaporize, but like her team was like just killing them, like shooting to kill or whatever. And maybe that's so they have different types of blast sounds.
The way those blasters vaporize people was so violent. It was awesome. Usually in Star Trek, it's not like that. You know, they'll disappear or fall down. But this was like, oh, that's painful.
Every vaporize has a Wilhelm scream with it. I like the hallway scene. I was like, that was really cool. But we have Michelle Yeoh here. Are we going to see? And then, yes, we totally see her kicking and her legs flailing in ways that shouldn't.
Kicking knives away from her?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
She kicked up all the way and hit his face.
Yeah.
And
he was behind her, right?
Behind her.
Wasn't he behind her and she somehow hit him in the face? She kicked him in the face.
And she can legit do that.
Yes.
It was so amazing. I love that whole fight scene. I was like, wow.
I got to talk to Clyde about that because he's been waiting for her to like unleash her Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, work here.
Yeah.
And she definitely made it happen here. Like she lost her sword for a while, but she picked up a few knives and she was just kniving people in the neck back and forth. Like,
and then for her to get that glory kill on Lorca from behind.
Right.
There's no honor to her. She was also the one who ghosted out of that battle and like sacrificed the rest of her squad when she was like, hollow vaporize. What's it called when they dissipate in
vaporize?
No, when they transport.
Beam?
Beam. She was like, beam me out of here.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know the terminology, you listeners. I'm sorry.
Grant's a newbie. But it's great that you're loving the show. Like I always say, like, you don't know Star Trek, but you're so into this show. And from my perspective, it's different, but this show is very Star Trek. I think you would like other Star Trek, Grant.
I don't know about this. Don't try and sell me on
that. All right.
I wanted to ask you, we saw that Stamets when he was lost in the mycelium network. I was under the impression that he had a deep connection and bond with the other Stamets as a result of this. Obviously, there's some pull between counterparts in the universes, right? And a similar trajectory. But I thought that because they shared a mind hive in that mycelium network, when one Stamets died, when Lorca pulled that prank of just like vaporizing him instead of kicking him through the hole,
right?
The evil trap door.
That was so good.
That other Stamets was going to feel that, right? But then I was sort of like, I guess it's not as big a deal as I was hoping.
Yeah, it felt like in the previous episode, like they had that bond.
Yeah.
And when they woke up at the same time, you know, and it did feel like they were connected, but I guess we're not getting that. But now that you remind me of when Lorca pulled that gag, like you think he's going to toss him into that their version of the spore drive.
Yeah.
But what he just gets vaporized by, didn't, what's her name? Landry vaporized?
Landry is back.
Is back, so who cares? not the most compelling character.
She plays a mean person in either universe.
Yeah. She's good at that. She's cutthroat. She played the same person in Battlestar Galactica too.
Okay.
So. Same character. But yeah, you know, we didn't see Mirror Stamets fall into that spore thing, but we saw Lorca. And that was probably for a reason. Maybe your theory is right.
Maybe he's going to exist somehow within that. Right. And if Stamets has to drop back into it, he's going to come across him.
Right. Well, maybe
do battle in the mushroom fields.
Yeah. And maybe it was cleaner. It would, if they are going to bring Lorca back inside the mycelial network because he fell into the energy bubble, whatever it was, it would be cleaner if he's the only one who fell in there. And Mirror Stamets was not in there as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what they're going to do with Lorca, but
I want him back.
I feel like doing that just allows the writers the wiggle room. Like, we can figure out another way if we want to bring Jason Isaacs back.
Yeah. I don't see why they wouldn't. He's such a great advocate for the show. He's such a great actor. Mm. Brings so much great presence. I don't know. And fans love him. I love him.
Yeah. Other thoughts?
You know, I did miss checking in with Ash this week because I find that to be a really compelling character and storyline. And I want to see if Vok is going to emerge again. So hopefully we'll see that. But this was just, it felt like a really lean and mean, just run and gun, fast-paced, riveting hour of television, which after the last two episodes, which were very good, I enjoyed, but there was some stuff that was pretty clunky in the last two. And this one just, it felt like the writers and directors really knew what they were doing. They really knew where they wanted to go, what story they wanted to tell, and they told it in an extremely compelling way. I was really happy.
The fact that we now have a Discovery ship that's under the leadership of Saru, and I don't think anyone else is going to challenge him for that role. Mm-hmm. I would assume he's the de facto leader.
Oh, no.
And everyone would want to follow him.
Everyone seems to want to follow him.
Especially after he gave that speech and it rallied everyone and gave them hope. And
no win scenario.
Yeah.
Which is a Kirk line.
So I'm liking that we're going to kind of stick to that. I was wondering, though, since we've mentioned the time travel aspect a few times here, I know that in the Star Trek 4 movie, is that the one, the whales?
Mm-hmm.
Return Home or something?
Voyage Home.
Voyage Home. What are the ethical boundaries that the Federation might have as far as playing with the time stream?
Not supposed to do it.
Not supposed to do it.
No.
Right?
I mean, they do it all the time, every chance they get. But it's always like, we're not supposed to do this, but kill the butterfly. Who cares?
Okay, that's kind of what I thought. I'm like, it's probably going to be another one of those, no one's looking, right? Shrug, let's go ahead and mess with it a little bit more. Because what we think is best is going to be best, regardless of how time has deemed that things were going to right. play out.
So you think we might get a Lost scenario where wasn't it a running theme on Lost where the people try to undo what time wants, that time will have its way anyway, you know?
Possibly. Yeah. But I think that I still feel like the Discovery is not meant for this time stream, this time period.
Right.
Because it has a technology that is a little bit too dangerous, and it would stand to reason, at least for me, that if they were to even win this war, that they would have to take that ship and classify it and hide it away because that it has too dangerous of power. And that's why no one else would really know about it.
We saw how dangerous it could be in this episode. Well, we were told, like we said, that it, you know, the Spore Drive and the Mycelial Network corruption could end the universe. So it feels like they laid that thread down in this episode where we're eventually going to get to the point where the characters will decide we have to destroy the Spore Drive. It's too dangerous and we can't give it to anyone else. I think that's where we're going to get.
We have two more episodes left?
Yes. Well, for this season.
See, in Lost terms, two episodes can be a two-hour finale. And if you think about the beginning of this show, the past is prologue in a way, because the first two episodes were a prologue for the rest of the series, and that set the template for how everything else played out. And I wonder if they're going to do a big two-parter. I find in most television that the penultimate episode is generally the most riveting, and then the finale just kind of allows them to tie up loose ends and set the stage for what they might want to do in the next season. But I don't know. It can be different show to show.
Yeah, that was definitely true for Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. Sopranos even too. And this show, even though it's a sci-fi show, it's on CBS All Access, its aim is to be a prestige drama. And we had an anti-hero throughout most of the season. So yeah, it kind of seems like they will be sticking to that prestige drama template that we know.
Man, this episode was so good. It felt like a season finale until the very end when they reveal that twist and they're like, okay, well, there's a little bit more they're going to obviously immediately explore.
Okay, I think we're good. Listener, remember that we come on the mics just not even an hour after we watch the episode. So if we don't dive in as deep as you would like, or we don't get to things, we miss stuff every now and then, you know, you can join the conversation too. Find us on Twitter, find us on Facebook. Just go to StarTrekPod.com. Talk to us there. We're also on YouTube. You can listen to us there. Leave some comments in the YouTubes. I know Grant likes to fight with the YouTube commenters.
I do like to argue. So if you're going to, yeah, be prepared.
Okay. And as I said before, you can visit us at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Give us a buck an episode. If you give us $2 an episode, you'll be able to join us on our private Slack channel called Lorca's Menagerie, where we talk about all things Star Trek Discovery. And I want to give a shout out to some of the listeners who are $2 patrons and just recently have joined us on the Slack channel. One of them, I'm not sure if I want to say the person's name, but how do we put this, Grant? Somebody heavily involved in Star Trek Discovery is a patron.
Yes.
Is a $2 patron. Someone that we've spoken to a lot before over the internets is a patron.
We have an official Star Trek individual. I don't know how to best phrase that.
We have a Trekker.
Yeah.
Wait, no, that doesn't work either, does it? No, we have somebody involved with the show who is helping to produce this podcast for you guys. And we really want to thank that person very much. And who knows? This person might show up in our private Slack channel. They're paying us enough that they have the invite. So the door is open for them.
And you can join too, guys. $2 an episode. If you guys want to give us $5, you can still have access. If you guys want to give us $100 an episode, I mean,
that's fine.
Yeah,
I'll take it.
Bless you.
Yeah. So I want to thank James. I want to thank Charlie Whitmore, Karen Chuplis, Jessica Trevino, Andrew Rich, Darcy Mitchell, Steven Stalkos, and Max Wirestone. These are all $2 patrons and up. I think some of these people even donated $5 an episode.
Sweet.
Thanks so much, guys. You're helping us to pay our media hosting, to keep the mics on, paying for studio costs. You're helping us do this podcast, and we love doing it for you every week. So thank you for supporting us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, y'all.
And another way you can support us, find us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you listen to the podcast. We're on Spotify too. Leave us a 5-star rating and review. You know what, guys? Find us on Facebook and leave us a 5-star rating on Facebook, because there's some people who left 3 and 4 stars. Yeah, there was one guy, I think, who left us like a 1 or 2 star the other day because we don't like Star Trek Enterprise.
Oh, yeah. I believe I also yelled at that person.
Good.
So just like if you go on YouTube and make a criticism, I'm going to yell at you.
Grant will yell at
you. I'll also criticize anyone who wants to go and just unnecessarily give us a low rating on
this.
Like, what are you doing?
I don't know. Scott Bakula fans, man. So find us online at StarTrekPod.com. Visit our podcast network, Permanent Record, PermanentRCRD.com. Grant, where can people find you on the internet?
Just go ahead and hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Baron Von Grant, BaronVonGrant.
You can find me at Mike Moody on Twitter. We're also at Star Trek Pod on Twitter. For now, long live the Empire.
Live long and prosper.
Kaplah.